Welcome to the Best Coast Political Podcast with Jeremy Cardona and Matt Dell, coming to you from the traditional territories of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples. How are you doing, Matt?
Hey, Jeremy. I am great. Friday afternoon for a long weekend. I'm excited. How are you doing?
Yeah, I am too, in theory, although I'm starting to feel kind of sick from the effects of the vaccine that I just got two days ago. So I'm feeling kind of
Good thing you got a long weekend. I was sick for a whole week with my vaccine. Honestly, it was not good, but it was worth it. But
what symptoms did you have?
Just like flu-like, sluggish, lightheaded. Went up one flight of stairs and was just exhausted.
I was okay for the first like day or two, but now I'm starting to feel kind of weird. We should probably talk about your the recognition that you've gotten over the last couple of days about. Well, do you want to talk about it? How you ended up in the news?
Well, not really. I'm on 2-week quarantine right now because I had an interaction with an anti-masker kind of person at a park with my son and the anti-masker child. I'll say that who we found out the day after we saw bumped into them randomly have COVID and had COVID for a week, and so my son was deemed high risk and my family's locked up for 2 weeks. So yeah, I've just kind of been sharing that story a little bit because I'm frankly pretty pissed off about it. And there's actually a bunch more people who are even more pissed off than me because they're closing their businesses and working. So just right. It's kind of nice to call these people out on really this just selfish and terrible action they're doing of refusing to care about society around them. So yeah, and it's got a good response of people who are equally pissed off because we want to get through this together, and you can't do it when people are refusing to follow the rules. This is how the virus spreads. So
yeah,
I'm on 2-week lockdown right now, and I'm glad we can do a podcast at least.
Did they know they had COVID?
This is all up for the debate right now. I don't know the details. We saw them on Sunday. Monday, they tested positive for COVID, although they'd had it all week for the previous week. So I don't know how honest they're being. I'm not sure. I don't want to speculate too much.
Contact tracing or something? Like, how did they know that your son was exposed? Contact tracing kind of thing?
Kind of, yeah. We had kind of heard through the grapevine that this person was positive. We kind of confronted them and then they admitted to it. I don't know if they would have told us otherwise. Our sons had been very close to playing together by coincidence at the skate park. And, you know, they're standing beside each other for 2 hours breathing this, that, and the other. So,
this has become a bit of a story. Matt talked about it on Facebook and Twitter, and it got kind of picked up across the country. And Matt got interviews or requests for interviews from a number of different media outlets. So you've been doing like a media tour about this, huh?
Well, I'm pissed off, honestly. And I'm just frustrated. I'm frustrated we haven't been calling out anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers enough. And I didn't expect it would happen to me. And I mean, we got tested for COVID on Sunday, so hopefully we will not have COVID. But yeah. Anyway, whatever. I'm trying not to dwell on it too much. I'm at home. My kids are great. I'm going to make the best of it. We got a podcast coming up right now, which I'm really excited about. So let me transition into that. This has been in the works for quite a while. My MLA is lucky enough to be Murray Rankin, the Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation. I've been talking to his staff about how my community can, you know, help on reconciliation efforts. And this podcast came about where we're talking finally to the Songhees Nation, Christina Clark, and Murray Rankin, the minister. And Christina is the corporate executive officer of the Songhees Development Corporation. So she is really leading this push of this new economic revival of the Songhees. And Murray, you know, he's the minister, and I'm really curious to see what this conversation is going to be like. I'm quite excited, and I just can't wait to listen and learn. I don't have as much connection to the Songhees people as I wish I did. I wish their stories were more prevalent. I wish, but this is the start of it. So that's on this agenda for today.
Yeah. And they have a phenomenal, relatively new wellness center, which is an absolutely gorgeous building out in the West Shore. If you haven't had a chance to see it, that has become like a community hub for them. And I think an economic driver and a cultural driver as well, and a place to connect. And it's really fantastic. So I've got a lot of questions for Christina, and I'm really interested to hear and learn from her. But I think this is an interesting podcast because we're used to thinking about reconciliation at the provincial and the federal level, but I think we all have a little bit less of an idea of what it might look like at the municipal or local government level. So I'm particularly interested to ask Murray about that and ask Christina about what cities like the city of Victoria or the city of Squamish can be doing to support reconciliation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we bring them on and hear from them?
Yeah, let's go.
want to welcome our guest today. We have Christina Clark, who is a corporate executive officer of the Songhees Development Corporation. Welcome to the podcast, Christina.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to chatting with you. And of course, we have Murray Rankin, who is my personal MLA, but also the Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation for the entire province. And first time chatting to Murray as well. So thanks for coming, Murray.
My pleasure, Matt. Great to be here.
So this came about through Murray and your staff, who I've been working with and have been so helpful. And I said, what's going on in reconciliation in Victoria? We talk about BC reconciliation. We talk about the provincial government, but what's my neighborhood doing? What's my street doing? What's Victoria doing? And I didn't know the answer to that, truthfully. And I didn't know where to go. And your staff said, hey, why don't we talk about it with Murray and Christina? And that's kind of how this whole thing came about. So I'm really excited to hear your take on urban reconciliation and what the Songhees and Songhees economic interest. And it seems that's a lot of the theme today. Maybe Christina, to ask you about that, is a lot of this economic revival of the Songhees Nation. There's so much going on. Is that fair to say this is a key, you know, mission for you right now?
Yes. And it was purposeful. We went on a journey about, West Bank First Nation, they've had a lot of success, and they have a saying, we are an overnight success story, 20 years in the making. And it's kind of like that with Songhees Nation. There were very deliberate decisions made by chief and council, which path to take, which legislation to explore, such as sectoral self-government under the Lands Management Act and the First Nations Fiscal Management Act. So those decisions laid out a map, and then the vision that the chief and council articulated that on behalf of the membership laid out the pathwork of what we were to do. And so we built the Songhees Wellness Center as it was a culmination of a dream of the nation. And what they wanted was a place to show they're still here, a place for them to gather and enjoy and learn and work and play. It's a gym. And it's an education center. It's a seat of government. It's the our municipal hall type of building. But we also wanted it to be an economic engine. And so we built in it an industrial kitchen because we knew we were going to get into hospitality, event space. And we implemented this legislation in order to be able to help us build that building. So we have a debenture bond under the First Nations Finance Authority for part of that building. And we were able to implement a lease very quickly under the First Nations Lands Management Act to create revenue streams to support the cost of it. It's a $25 million building. Mm-hmm. Wow. But we're cash neutral on it because we created new revenue streams to support it.
It seems this has given you a new energy and a new kind of lust for reconceptualizing what the Songhees is going in. Like I sense a lot of momentum, excitement, energy, some of the projects we'll talk about later, but it must be a bit exciting to think about this with this new lens.
And part of was purposeful too, that it was a community driven. The chief and council asked membership to step forward if they wanted to be part of the Songhees Wellness Center. And so I got the privilege of facilitating that committee, and that was an 8-year journey. And on that, we had a strategy session or a strategic, or just brainstorming the first day, first meeting, and flip charts up and said, okay, if we could have anything and money was no object, what would we build? Mm-hmm. And we dreamed up the Songhees Wellness Center, and then we just never pared it down. We just decided we wanted that and we would make it happen. And it took 8 years, but we did. And it's LEED Silver, it's 50,000 square feet. And we operate multiple businesses out of it. And we run education and health, employment programming, after school programming. And it's the pride in our membership over having such a beautiful building. Like we spent $2 million on art, yeah, on the carvings and on the historical, like the photographs. We worked with Simon Fraser University and Bill Reed Foundation to get photographs from museums all over the world of the Lekwungen people. And we filled the wellness center with them so that children would grow up seeing these old photos and hearing the stories, because you know they walking down the hall, what's that? Stories getting told. And we put language in many places in the building. We put words to express what we were trying to achieve. And so people start talking the language. And then the other thing that they said is we want the people to know that we're still here and we're thriving, and we want this building to express our pride and our prosperity that we're building.
Thank you so much, Christina. It's fabulous to hear about what the Songies have been doing and about the vision and about how the Wellness Center fits into that. I just want to pull Murray Rankin into this conversation a little bit more and say, Murray, talk to us a little bit about the role that local governments have in addressing reconciliation.
So yesterday I had a long conversation with the Union of BC Municipalities, and you know that that's sort of the group for all of local government. Every September they have this gigantic event that every politician has to be at, and you know, they said we have three priorities. First priority was housing. Another priority was mental health and addiction. But you know what? The second priority was the need to implement UNDRIP at the local level, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. They have a very forceful committee, a very powerful committee on Indigenous reconciliation. I got to tell you, 20 years ago, local governments were not enamored of the agenda of reconciliation. Now there's been just a sea change, probably brought about by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action, probably enhanced by the province of British Columbia unanimously passing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act, the only place in outside of Bolivia where that's been done. And so that obviously means local government stepping up. And so when we talk about stuff happening in our area, there's economic, as you said, Matt, there's economic aspects. But I think the success of reconciliation is going to be not about how many agreements we create, and it's going to be about what it's like for an Indigenous child in the future. Will he or she have the same economic outcomes, the same educational outcomes? Will we have will we still have murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls? Will we still have a high rate of incarceration of Indigenous people in prison? The metrics that we have to measure reconciliation with have to be about individuals and their life outcomes. That's what this is all about.
Fantastic. Yes,
and when it's driven by the goals and dreams of the people, it can be so powerful, because with that project, when it almost didn't come to pass, when things that we thought we were going to get legacy funding for the Olympics that were coming up, and then we had the market crash during that whole process, and it was elders that said, it's time. And we deserve this. And it was the really young ones who said, why not? They believed it was possible. And that pure belief that it can be done made it actually happen. But point of raising that about self-directed is the reason why economic reconciliation is making so much traction is that it's very self-directed by the nations. It's not somebody else's program. When we build an economy, we're entering it on our terms. I mean, there are examples of all kinds of lopsided agreements between people, but at least in our context, and many that I've seen, when you come together in business, it is an act of reconciling your goals and working together to figure it out. And when you're partnered with industry and you're trying to work through regulatory regimes and different jurisdictional issues, and you're bumping up against systemic problems, and you're working with government bureaucrats to fix those problems, and then it becomes this movement to fix things. And I'm constantly working with people both in industry and local government and provincial and federal government, and certainly First Nation government, that are actively working to deconstruct. Because over the years, we built workarounds. We had a Indigenous Canada, ISC used to be called INAC, Indigenous Northern Affairs Canada. We call that, I need another copy. Because every piece of paper you'd send them, they would lose. And the other tactic was, if somebody was assigned to your nation, a funding services officer, and you got too much money, they got too good at helping you find money, they move them immediately. Yeah. And you watch it happen all over. So those kind of systemic things. Now the people in those roles, and I think it in large part too, because the leadership at the national level, the provincial level, has set the tone of wanting change. and mandate letters have set that tone. It takes a long time to filter all the way through, but I believe government workers are taking that very seriously, that work, and actively trying to do it.
Christina, what is the economic dimension of reconciliation? What does economic reconciliation actually mean? When I think historically we're accustomed to discussing reconciliation in terms of historical injustice, colonialism, residential schools, and making right, in some sense, all the historical wrongs that have taken place over the last couple hundred years. What's the economic dimension of that?
You know, I think an excellent example, we'll talk about the Songhees Indigenous Marine Trail. So, okay. And we labeled that because we were able to get stimulus funding to acquire a passenger landing craft and funding for interpretive signage. And so we developed 12 points of interest from the Songhees Wellness Center all the way over to Cordova Bay, places where things are already happening and places that are important to us. Megan, you know, Beacon Hill Park, like the welcome pole that will go up at the International Arena. Fort Rod Hill is another place, Royal Roads, in the Inner Harbor where the Spindle Whirls are. So as we were putting together the proposal to do that, and we were looking at the land and we were connecting this trail, we realized we're looking at Lekwungen territory the way the Lekwungen people always have, from the water. And the connections between each of those points are relationships within the territory. And as we move into the territory and we look at this marine trail plan, we have a set of stakeholders for each area. Those stakeholders are local government, local business people, private landowners, community groups, industry partners. That's reconciliation. And what we're trying to do is bring, before 1911, the Lekwungen people, when the fort was being built, were integrated economically. They were selling fish. They were helping build the fort. They were trading cannas, the starchy vegetables. They were integrated into the economy and the trade economy as other nations came to trade. They paid respect. They paid tribute to the Lekwungen people. So it was a prosperous time. But in 1911, when they were pushed out of the Inner Harbor and pushed off of Songhees Point and out to where the reserve is, that was when their economy, the doors were slammed shut on the economy. They were kicked out of the local economy. They had the Indian Act at that time with incredible, terrible, that nowadays we can't even understand it, but you're not allowed to leave the reserve without a permit from the Indian agent. You're not allowed to hire a lawyer. You're not allowed to gather in groups of people. You're not allowed to dance. You're not allowed to wear masks. You're not allowed to give away your property in a potlatch. So that created a depression, an economic and social depression. Then you add residential schools on top of that. You add the 60s scoop on top of that. You add the missing and murdered women and the incarceration rates on top of that. And you have, and then the reserve system, the jurisdictions, little issues, the way it's managed, the relationship between the province and the feds and the relationship with local government, the reserves became these incredibly isolated. So in an urban reserve, I have know many band members who hadn't barely left their community to go downtown. And they would stay very close together, travel together to other communities and visit with them, have specific places that they visit, but not socially, economically, or culturally integrated into the community where they live. Wow. To the extent that neighbors didn't necessarily know they were there. I grew up in Gordon Head, and I didn't know about Songhees and Esquimalt.
Yeah.
So coming back into the territory to do business is coming back into the economy. And all of this stakeholder engagement is rebuilding the relationships that are the fabric of our economy. Yeah. So this work is reconciliation because it is bringing our worlds back together.
Yeah, I like how so much. Oh, go ahead, Murray.
I was just going to say, Jeremy's question I thought was a really provocative one. Like, what does it mean? We talk a lot about reconciliation. And so while Christina was speaking, I looked it up and it means the action of making one view or belief compatible with another. I think reconciliation is the action of making one culture compatible with another, but in a place of equality rather than settlers, the colonial relationship that settlers have had with Indigenous people. And I got to tell you, as a person who grew up in Canada, how little I knew about Indigenous people in my education system. I went to a public school system, pretty good system, and I did not, the words residential school never came up once in my education. And I suspect that's the case for many. But now, as part of the provincial commitment, you won't be able to graduate from a high school in our province without knowing history and culture of Indigenous peoples. We have got a thriving, varied culture. A lot of people who live in our community, of course, there's Squamalt and Songhees, Lekwungen speaking peoples, Wasanik people from the peninsula, but gee, there are some 204 nations in BC alone. And then there are we have half the languages of Indigenous languages of Canada right here in BC. And many of those people have found their way to the island and live in our communities. So how do we reconcile that culture in a decolonizing way and get to a place where we are, our views and our beliefs and our cultures are compatible with one another? That sounds kind of highfalutin, but reconciliation also means doing the hard work of finding on the terms that the Indigenous people want us to use, not what we impose on them in a paternalistic colonial kind of way, but how do we ensure that we're coming together as equals, government to government, and forging a better future for Canada? That's what this is about. And the good news is, I think there's a willingness like never before on the part of non-Indigenous people in Canada to do just that.
That's a really simple explanation, which I quite like, Marie. Like, I actually have never heard the definition of simplified, as you just said it right there, of nation to nation, culture to culture. And it's actually quite a nice way to think about it because it's very easy to understand. It's not necessarily about this or that. It's just cultural and social equality. So I really like that. One of the things that I think is really exciting about this, what Christina, you're talking about, is it also allows you to tap into your historical culture and knowledge based around the water, which is kind of awesome that you get to tie it into the historical relationship of your people. There's this cool connection there, and also this incredible opportunity of like, why not use, and I think this is what the term the blue economy, I don't know a lot about that term, but I understand it to mean like a ocean-based economy, whether it be cleanup. And I understand you're doing a lot of work, so you have these boat tours, which sounds so fantastic, and I can't wait to go on one. But my understanding is there's some cleanup economy work happening there, and you're getting involved in all that.
So we got involved in marine industry in 2011 or 2012. Late chiefs Andy Thomas and Robert Sam and Ian Maxwell came together and formed Sailor Sea Industrial Services. But the orientation towards stewardship, even for lands that the nation no longer controls or has a lot of influence in, no one's ever let go of that sense of stewardship over it. And one of the things I'm wanting to do with the Clean Coast Project is shout that from the rooftops, that Indigenous stewardship still exists and the communities are quietly doing all kinds of things. And we want to be leaders in the blue economy of cleaning up the ocean. Let us at it. We want to do it. We're ready to do it. We've already been doing it. We already know intimately these places. And I thought of something when Marie was talking about, now this seems like a simple thing, but every time that you're at a meeting nowadays, you hear a territorial acknowledgement and everybody's picked up, okay, this is important. We need to learn how to do this. The reason it's important is tied in with reconciliation. Because from a Lekwungen perspective, if your land isn't recognized, that you are of that land, then you're not recognized. And I was I was with a band member in a municipal meeting, and the mayor made an acknowledgement, and very kindly, but he said Coast Salish people. And when it was our turn, we were there to do a presentation. And what she said was, when you tell me who I am, you take away who I am. And there was a lot of perplexed looks. And I had the CAO chasing me down the hallway afterwards, help me understand what happened. And I said, because she's Lekwungen, and only Lekwungen people can claim this land. And if Coast Salish, we used to war against Coast Salish too, other Coast Salish, right? So Coast Salish goes way down into the States and way all over the place. So the Kwangin people would disappear if this was Coast Salish territory. It's the Kwangin territory.
Wow.
And when we do a survey with our members, how do you want to your story? What do you want people to know about you? And the first thing they say is our relationship to this place. That's who we are. We are this place. It's interchangeable. They can't conceive of I'm not othering, but I'm referring to, I'm not Lekwungen, but Lekwungen people do not conceive of themselves with outside of the context of Lekwungen territory.
It's
so closely tied.
And that's why I think, Matt, it's so important that we note, as you started to do, the work that the Songhees are doing to improve the territory of the Lekwungen people, namely it's a marine environment, to clean up some of the plastic pollution, that the derelict vessels that are on our coastline. And the province recently, the Songhees received $2 million to clean up about 100 derelict vessels from the waters of Southern Vancouver Island. And they have done that, as Christina said, in the past. And this is a really important thing, not for everybody, to clean up our environment. Plastic, the scourge of plastic pollution, is something we've got to address head on. And who better than the Songhees, with the skills that they've had, the experience that they've had, and the desire to make that territory more pristine. I think that's what Christina's saying.
And we're thinking quite regionally too, it's interesting because in the industry, there's a competitive environment, but we, nation to nation, are less, there's less of that. There's more of let's share what we do and let's help each other. So when we were putting together this project, I was reaching out to all other nations on the South Island. Do you want to be part of this? And Beecher Bay First Nation, where I live in the Spirit Bay development in Beecher Bay, Chianu. They ran a dive program. They trained divers, and they opened it up to other communities. So there's lots of Chianu people and people from other nations. So we partner with them. They'll be the divers on this job. And we advertise the positions for the seizure crew to all the South Island nations. And our interview will not, I'm interviewing Tuesday, but our team will not be all Songhees, because there's a regional workforce that we're all drawing from. And we all have very small communities. And you know, take the example of Songhees, we're in hospitality, we're in tourism, we're in marine industry, we're in cannabis retail. And many of those are very job heavy. That's partly why we got into them. But not all of our band members want to be in tourism or want to be in hospitality. And how many people would it take to populate all of those positions and allow those companies to grow? So we work with other nations, and it's so building an indigenous labor market here.
Thank you, Christina. That's fascinating and really heartening to hear. And I just want to bring Murray back in here too, and just keep going on this question of the role of local governments in reconciliation. I mean, I think we're so accustomed to thinking about it as a provincial and a federal issue. And in fact, Christina has noted that the Songhees have been able to get some resources from higher levels of government. But I want to just hear a little bit more about what local governments can be doing to support, for instance, the Songhees or similar kinds of economic reconciliation developments that are occurring.
Well, I had a conversation with the president of UBCM, who's from Vanderhoof, from Mayor Tate, who's out in Souk, and a counselor from Coquitlam, who is head of the Indigenous Relations Committee of UBCM. And they're all struggling with your very question, Jeremy. They're all trying to figure out just what is the best way, acknowledging as we want the need as a local government to try to decolonize our institutions and have a better relation with Indigenous citizens within our population, but often who are neighbors to ours. They might be living in a community just outside a municipality. I'll give you a good example. Let's say that the federal government has primary responsibility for reserves, as they do. And let's say that a municipality wants to zone something, has an official community plan, and the federal government, who takes responsibility for better or for worse, usually for worse, of the community that lives there, who lives on the reserve, that federal enclave, how do you make that work? How do you make sure that the values and interests of the non-Indigenous community are aligned with the people who live right next door? And say you want to collaborate on some economic development or some growth or change in the community. How do you make sure that the Indigenous people are going in the same direction? That's a great example of what really happens in many communities around British Columbia, where they're trying to get it right. They're trying to work in partnership as they never were before. I mean, let's be candid. In the past, we would often just ignore the interests of First Nations people living on reserves or living in communities nearby. Now I think there's increasingly a genuine desire to work together. But we got the complexity of Father Ottawa. Christina spoke earlier about the Diane. And I mean, they're trying to do their best. I think they too are trying to, you know, decolonize and improve the reconciliation agenda, but it's difficult. So that's one practical example. We've seen issues of that in Victoria, haven't we, with the controversy over John A. MacDonald and the statue at City Hall. That is all about efforts of trying to ensure that our history is preserved, but on the other hand, recognizing the great injustices that have happened in the past, particularly felt by Indigenous people. It's a complicated question you ask.
Can I bring Christina in on that? Because I was going to ask you, Christina, how Jeremy and I thinking a lot about local government and what does reconciliation mean for the city and for my neighborhood and Fernwood and Jubilee for me? Have you been working with the city, and do you find, are there avenues for the Songhees to work closely and clearly with the community? Like what are, I couldn't name the big initiatives.
What they're trying to do is, first of all, their engagement, you know, the volume of engagement's quite high. So how we started with the dinner party thing. So we invited them to our place. We went over to their place. Actually, we had dinner like 3 or 4 times, really enjoyed each other, just laughing and eating and not even talking politics or anything specific. And what we would do with those meetings, we invite our senior staff and introduce them. So then we would have their parks department call on our lands manager, and you know, the executive assistant calling the chief's assistant, and those connections weren't there before, and that really helps. Yeah. But as far as initiatives go, like the city family piece was that they brought together representatives from the city and representatives from the nations and formed a family, and they were following the guidance from the community about what the family would be like. It's like, okay, we're going to come together around this table as a family and solve a problem. And so they explored what can we do. And they came up with, well, that statue is an affront. Let's take it down. The irony was that when that happened, and the city came to the chief of council and said, you know, are you comfortable with this? And the council was a little hesitant, actually, and said, this is going to come back on us. And they said, we'll do everything we can to protect you. But I saw some of the hate mail, and they couldn't protect us from that. And it was pretty significant, the hatred that came out.
It was bad.
There was hatred. There were people, there were outside influences in Facebook that saw it flare up, and through whatever you throw on it to make it worse.
Yeah. It was really ugly. It was not good about that discussion at all.
And the dialogue wasn't healthy at all. It wasn't a healthy dialogue about, you know, there's a reason why in Scotland they don't have statues about that man.
Yeah. Well, he was personally involved with banning the potlatch and the act itself, and was.
Yeah, he was the one that said we have to kill the Indian in the child.
Yeah. So, you know, it made perfect sense to me why you'd want to remove it from the front of City Hall. Do you think that process could have or should have happened differently? Or are you okay with how it ended up playing out?
I was okay with how it ended up playing out, because I thought, you know, the flushing out of the racism is beneficial because people could see it. Mm-hmm. And people were like, oh my, look at this. And I would tell people, you know, with Indigenous communities were early adopters of Facebook. There's a lot of people on Facebook that are engaging with the world there, but not necessarily talking to somebody in the grocery store. Right. So they're seeing the world's opinion of them through that window and thinking everybody hates them.
Mm.
And in those that we get out to come and work in tourism and stuff, they're surprised that people don't hate them.
One of my wishes that I think is so cool is that the Songhees people were all over the Victoria region. And, you know, I think sometimes I think of Songhees as very Inner Harbor focused, but that's not true. They were traveling throughout the region, you know, doing whatever, living.
Albert Head all the way over to past Cadboro Bay and on some of the San Juan Islands.
And you've had some luck in Oak Bay recently, my understanding. There's been some good progress there. What's happening in Oak Bay and how does that kind of link into the whole Songhees traditional territories and your kind of vision for the region? You
know, it's a work in progress, trying to work together with community groups and with local governments to get a common understanding of what we're trying to achieve. And we had dinner with them and you know, I miss our former mayor, Niels. I worked with him on the Harbor Authority board. We formed relationships and we're able to call one another and they're making efforts with reconciliation and Mayor Murdoch too. And, you know, him and the chief will get on the phone and talk about things. Or if there's a challenge for them, they will talk to each other straight up. That's really healthy and positive.
And I would just add, Christina, that they are, of course, are politicians, and they are responding to an increasing interest on reconciliation in their population. So the community association, yes, of Oak Bay that I've spoken with, there's several of them, and they're very interested in what specific.
They reached out to Songhees and said, are you satisfied with this procedure for how we're handling the marina? And I can't speak too much on that, but I do just want to say, no, we were not satisfied with, mm-hmm, with the consultation and with the way that the whole process was. I think it was flawed and we feel left out of a really important conversation.
Yeah, I can see that, you know, where people want the best elements of reconciliation that suit them and sometimes maybe don't want to do some of the more challenging work that doesn't suit them. And like city building, we lost you, there you are, Murray. Just talking about sometimes people wanting the best elements of reconciliation, but maybe not wanting to do the hard work. And that's so classic with any sort of city building issue, like everything has such opposition. And I mean, it's disappointing to hear because I think reconciliation does require us to put down some of those strongly held ideas we have in Western society about development or money or this or that, and to go, okay, this can't jive with what Songhees are looking for in this place. And if you truly believe in it, you have to let go of some of those notions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of those assumptions, those base assumptions that are cultural assumptions, and people, understandably, growing up in with a common school system, everybody kind of thinks the same way about things and takes for granted that that's the way we all think, but we don't all think that way. There's lots of people, newcomers to our country or Indigenous Canadians and people who do not have the same worldview and feel othered often with the way that people talk about us and we. I mean, people say, you're our First Nations. You know, we've got our First Nations. They're not yours.
Yeah.
They're not yours. And it's so people have, there's language needs to be shifted, and that's worldview stuff.
Yeah.
And in order to get there, the exploration is needed. It's a little bit similar with what we're watching the United States grapple with their issues with racism, that there's the real overt piece of it, but it's almost more difficult to deal with the subtler, more subtle aspects of racial bias that people can carry without realizing it. And I'm not talking critical race theory and saying everybody's racist. So that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we all have biases. And when those are pervasive, and there's a lot of people sharing them, they can be destructive. And in order to end that, people have to explore the language they use. And as an example, not a racial one, but there's a lot of us trying to say unhoused instead of homeless.
Yeah.
Because and people go, it's politically correct. What does difference does it make? It does, words matter, and we're shifting. It's about dignity and understanding the plight of that individual person. And so questioning how our assumptions and starting to why do I think that is the work of the individual. That's individual reconciliation, that piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. And that all makes perfect sense to me. And I wanted to sort of tie that into the conversation that we're having about economic development too. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity, Christina, to talk a little bit more about what are the economic goals of the Songhees First Nation moving forward?
Oh. So we started out with the goal of having successful businesses that were operating and generating jobs and opportunities, creating an environment where entrepreneurs will thrive and participating in the regional economy, mm-hmm. and generating surplus revenue. Those are the goals that we started with. And now after having our development corporation in its new form is now in its, you know, heading into its third year, and we're starting to look at what does the next phase look like. And that has a lot to do with the property that we have and the development that will happen. What does the future look like? We know that tourism and hospitality is something our members are very interested in, and it's very natural with the storytelling and sharing of food. It aligns culturally. And so we are working with young people. We're doing a series of culture camps on Chess, the Chatham Discovery Islands, Songhees Islands, Chess. We're doing just camps on them to traditional knowledge transfer and bringing all the families together, because you've got, there's so much richness in knowledge and traditional knowings that people have. But there are families who, you know, maybe they're a victim of the 60s scoop and they didn't grow up in their community, and they don't know, they've never been to their own islands. They don't know traditional medicines. Those people are hungry to find who they are and come back home. Hmm. So, and so for young people, they maybe even grew up in the reserve, but in a family with a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. Some families, everyone's on their own healing journey, and people are at different points. And when you're in the early stages of it, there can be substance abuse and a lot of the social ills that was a result of the trauma. But we've reached almost a critical mass of people that are actively working on healing their trauma, and that unleashing their own creativity as people, that and raising their children that way, that the future is very, very bright. The attitude of the young people is very positive and hopeful. And it gives me great hope for the future of our country.
I think it's a really lovely one. And bring it back to the trail. I mean, it sounds like is that geared towards local residents, or would you call that a tourism endeavor? Like, coming from the Coho and the Clipper and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and cruises, if we come back. It's a destination development project, and we're setting ourselves up as a destination management organization. So we retain control. So we'll have tours people can book online, so people can book them from all over the world. But we're, as much as it's terrible that we're going through COVID, we're having a little window of opportunity where our members can get out there and develop the story develop the talent for telling the story. And that breather is really, really going to help us. So this summer is going to be very pivotal. And the after the summer, we'll really get to have a sense of where the members want to go fast. But we look at clean tech and with interest, you know, vertical farming. The Innovation Center, the Wellness Center, is a center with Indigenous tech, and he's grown from, they had 11 staff last 2 years ago. They have 25 now. They'll have 40 by the end of the year, and almost entirely Indigenous staff. And these are software developers. They're all kinds of skilled people. So I'd like to build a space that can grow, so that our members, you know, they did a robotics camp with their kids, and several kids said, I'm going to do that when I grow up. And that's what we want kids looking at, is the future that they want to see and start planning for how they're going to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we're at. There were some dark days in the 90s and the early 2000s where there was not hope at all for very many people.
Well, and having that center allows that dream to come to fruition. And what I particularly like about the tourism aspect too is that tens of thousands of people come to this region every year. And right now, unless they're going to the art, you know, to the Royal BC Museum and they're learning about Indigenous culture, there's a good chance they come here and they don't learn really anything about the Songhees First Nation.
Yeah, and but even if they go to the museum, it's very quiet about the Lekwungen. There's no recognition that Lekwungen has a people.
You know, and badly in need of a refresh and update too on a lot of the knowledge there, as I'm sure you know. But you know, doing the Marine Trail would be a fantastic opportunity for people to interface with the First Nation, actually learn about what they're doing now.
Yes, yeah. And where we go from there is connecting with other nations so that you can do Indigenous tourism experience all the way up the island, all the way up the province. There's so much. And we're very, for us, tourism, you know, sometimes it's the dance performances and it's traditional foods and talking about history, but people are really interested in what's happening right now. And we can take a tour through the Songhees Wellness Centers. Here's our seat of government. And we have a property tax department and a bylaw department. And that's fascinating for people.
Yeah. And you know, I'll be the first to raise my hand and say that I am sometimes guilty of the fact that I'm trained as an historian. And I like to think I know a fair bit about Indigenous culture, but I sometimes find myself referring to Indigenous peoples in the past tense. You know, they were doing this, they did this, they lived here. And I'm constantly having to remind myself, no, we have to talk about First Nations in the present tense, because it's easy to fall back into what was going on historically and the farming of Camas and the Gary Oak ecosystem and all of that. And you end up sort of, I think, inadvertently relegating Indigenous people to the past. And I think I'm not alone in sometimes not purposefully doing that, but I'm the first.
You're right. And an example of it is even we're bringing in Indigenous awareness into the school system. It's often the first chapter of a textbook and it's all about history and then that's it.
Right. Exactly.
And what about the present and the future?
Yeah.
And we want Indigenous people to see themselves in the future of Canada.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting trend about Indigenous like comics and storylines about a futuristic Indigenous, you know what, and that is an effort to see themselves in the future. Uh-huh. But the loss people experience about the things that aren't there anymore, the things they can't harvest anymore, it's painful to witness because they feel it and talk about it a lot. And you know, Cecilia said something to me the other day. She's our cultural tours lead, and she said when two people come together in the longhouse and they're meeting each other and they speak in Lekwungen, I don't have English words to tell you what that means. Uh-huh. The coming together, the respect for one another, the respect for your house, the intent to do good work together. English doesn't express those, what our culture means.
Right.
So all the people that don't have language, they don't have all that extra meaning to their life.
Are there opportunities for non-native speakers to learn Lekwungen? Could I learn Lekwungen?
There isn't a Lekwungen curriculum yet. There is lots of curriculum for Tsimshian, which is a very closely related language. And there's a language school out in Saanich for that. And we have language teachers actually from Saanich that come to Songhees. So they talk about having a blanket over the language. And they talk about, because it got down to one or two speakers.
Wow.
And those elders, like Joan is one, but when she speaks, she's speaking Lekwungen, Tsimshian, and Halkomelem mixed, because that's what happened when there were fragments of the language left and they would use it with one another. And it's this kind of mix. And now that you got purists trying to untangle it, and what's just Lekwungen? And others say, no, that's how I speak. That's how I talk about, like, growing up in the longhouse, we always spoke Halkomelem. So that they're grappling, people that they're having to grapple with that themselves. Uh-huh. Which language is mine, you know? So there is, like, for example, they're encouraging everybody that works for Songhees Nation, no matter where they come from, to learn as much Lekwungen as they can. And we will use Lekwungen with visitors. And at some point, there probably will be some kind of a class. I would love to, through tourism, have one where at least we could teach people how to say hello, and you know, a greeting, and how to say where you're from.
I don't know how the Songhees First Nation would feel about it, but I would, in theory, love to see it being taught, basic Lekwungen being taught in public schools. I'd like my daughters to know how to speak basic. I mean, they learn basic French and Russian and German, but they don't know a single word. Maybe they know Haichka.
There's this fear of loss that's so intense. And from him from India, and he was trying to understand that fear. And I said, well, if you think about it, in India, there are millions of people that speak your language. I know there's multiple languages, but for, you know, there are, for each language, there's millions of people that know how to cook the foods and that know the history. There are less than 700 Lekwungen people. If you ask Songhai, there's less than 1,000 between the two nations. They're afraid that there won't be Lekwungen people in the future, that they won't know Lekwungen, that they won't know their history. So they're, and because of the anti-potlatch and all that clamping down, and because they're so urbanly located, have to go really underground. And things that, like, there's always been secret societies, but things that weren't secret are secret now because they were pushed underground and no one knows how to bring them back up again. And they're afraid when they bring it up that they're going to lose it, that others are going to take it. But there's also a movement to share, like work with GVHA and CRD and do burning ceremonies together, where they're part of the ceremony. They're participating right culturally, right in the ceremony. And for some Indigenous people, that feels really good. That feels like healing to them. And to others, that's threatening.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Christina. I want to jump in. Like, we've already been here going for an hour, and I think I could spend a couple hours just listening to you. You tell such great stories and have really good insight. It's just awesome. And I think I just want to say, for me living in Victoria, it doesn't feel good living in a place where I only know one piece of the culture here, a very colonial industrial culture from 100 years. I don't like that. I want to know the story of how this land was for the last, my understanding is 4,000 or 5,000 years, having Lekwungen people in this area. And there's just so much, you know, beauty and things to know about that. And but Murray, we didn't get to hear too much from you because Christina had so much, you know, fantastic things to say there about our local culture. But did you want to throw in any final words on her thoughts or where you're at right now?
Not really much to add, except it's been a great conversation. I think Christina's done an excellent job of enlightening us. I hope when listeners have an opportunity to hear the podcast, that they will reflect on this community, as I think Jeremy was saying, how we can understand better the history around us, but not just the history, as he pointed out, but the future of dynamic culture that is definitely coming on strong with great economic opportunities, and all the things we need to do to sort of hold each other up after the pandemic is going to be at the fore. How can we make sure that our economic prosperity and the hope that post-pandemic recovery is positive, and it's expected to be, that it doesn't leave anyone behind. And I'm thinking of the Indigenous population here in the Lower Island. And I'd like people to reflect on that, how we can work together.
That's a great message.
Thank you so much for that, Murray. And I just want to thank Christina and Murray again for taking the time out of their busy schedules to come and talk to us about this hugely important topic. I think it's been a really enlightening conversation. I just want to express my gratitude to the both of you.
Thank you very much. It's fun. Nice to talk to you again, Christina, as well.
You as well. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, Christina, I can't wait to follow your work. So I'm looking forward. It's just a nice thing to meet you in person. And now I can follow and go, okay, I know who's doing this. And I get to follow more eagerly all this exciting work that you're doing. And I can't wait to catch up again.
Hey, Matt, we'll do the trail together. We'll do the trail together, all four of us.
I'm going to hold you to that. Trail.
Just want to thank our guests, Christina Clark from the Songhees First Nation and Murray Rankin, Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation, for taking the time to come on the podcast today. I thought it was a really enlightening conversation.
Yeah. Anytime I get to hear about local Indigenous history, it just reminds me how I need so much more of that in my life and in our city. And it's just this incredible wealth of knowledge and culture. Christina was fascinating to listen to. So, you know, I would love to have that person like Christina and others from the song he's on and just kind of hear their stories about the land. It's just, it's kind of wrong that we live here and don't know about this history pre-settler and pre-colonialism.
Well, not just the history, but that she was making the point of like what's going on now, right?
I mean, yes. This a good point.
Marine Trails Initiative, and they are working to clean up all the derelict boats. We didn't even really talk too much about where and how, where the hell are all these derelict boats coming from, by the way? Like, what is the story on that? But yeah, the song is, they've got a number of irons in the fire in terms of economic reconciliation, which is a term we had a chance to talk about today, which I haven't thought that much about. When I think about reconciliation, I think mostly about treaties and politics and water, you know, boil advisory, that sort of thing, and the Wet'suwet'en and land claims. And But then there's this whole other economic dimension to it, right? Which is that First Nations want to get more involved in businesses and businesses that align with their values. So I thought that was really interesting for me to hear.
Yeah, and like, how exciting is it we get to watch this now? Like, we get to watch this. They have their hands in a million different, you know, economic kind of projects right now. They all sound awesome. This tour, everything sounds great. So I can't wait to watch this unfold. We have invited them back anytime they want just to listen. And that was really enlightening. I'm glad we did that. Yeah, we'll post it. And I think this is probably a theme we should keep on as you know, Songhees and helping them kind of spread what's going on there and getting local buy-in for some of these cool businesses to support that.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to go take a post-vaccine nap now.
Okay. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Next time.
Well, I can see that you can't win for trying. New Year's Eve is bound to leave you crying. Come on home. Come on home. No, you don't have to be alone. Just come on home. Moon and stars hang out in bars just talking. I still love that picture of us walking, just like that old house we thought.